I think 2016 is going to be a terrible year for civil liberties around the world. Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and this is the Editor's Roundtable. Today, I'm joined by David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Also with us is Laura Jakes, deputy managing editor of FP News. Finally, we have FP columnist Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. So, welcome back. Let's talk about 2016. David, you're at the New York Times. You're at the hub, the nerve center of the world. Every piece of useful information and even some pieces of less than useful information flow through the New York Times. What do you think is going to be the biggest global story of 2016?
Well, I think the biggest global story of 2016 is going to be whether or not we are on a process to resolve the war in Syria and with it the war against ISIS. I think the second biggest one is probably going to be in an area we've talked about in past podcasts.
The Kardashians.
Well, I realize that you spend most of your time thinking about the Kardashians, but while you do that, Lara and Corey and I are thinking about things like cyber and much
what
more
is the
boring.
Cyber story? What is the cyber story that you expect is going to happen that you don't think we're prepared for?
I don't think that we are prepared for a long series of short of war attacks. In other words, not something that shuts down the internet, something that shuts down the power system, something that turns off the electricity to Corey's hot tub out there at the Hoover Institution, which would be a true crisis, but instead a series of debilitating individual attacks. And they could be on companies. They could be on websites. But what we're discovering now is that this technology is so cheap and so easy that it's not going to be outside the world of ISIS or Anonymous, obviously, or others to go off and be able to wreak more havoc here, change the nature of data and so forth. So I think you're going to see a more subtle approach to that. And then we have this little presidential election coming along, which you dealt with in our last podcast. But based on current facts, if I think the biggest risk that the Republican Party runs right now is that this whole debate that we have had about allowing Muslims into the country, a wall against Mexico, the whole nativist approach, whether the Republicans get beyond the point where that defines their party no matter who the candidate.
And the Republican Party, if that's the case, becomes the Whig Party of 2016. This is the last election which will involve the Republican Party.
In its current form, I think that's probably true. And what you're seeing to some degree is a party that couldn't deal with the fact that its old base was both older and whiter than the overall electorate, and that ignored the advice that was taking place after Romney's defeat, that they had to figure out a way to reach out. And there is a war within the party right now between those who believe that they've got to broaden their base and those who believe that they can go back to this core.
Corey, this is your opportunity to defend the policies of Henry Clay.
Corey was actually his national security advisor.
And by the way, the nation was secure.
We were secure. We were not attacked. We were also engaged in relentless genocide against our neighbors, and slavery. But otherwise, things were great. Top two stories for 2016?
Top news stories for 2016. The Republican Party wins the war on the Republican Party and demonstrates that it is broad-minded, interested in inclusion, and moving forward. Second big news story.
Uteruses across America are withering as you speak.
Jesus, David.
Well, I mean, because we're talking about how the Republican Party doesn't like Muslims or the Republican Party doesn't like Mexicans, but I think it's well established the Republican Party doesn't like women.
So the Republican Party has two presidential candidates who are Latino, and they have one presidential candidate that's a woman. So the second big news story of 2016, I think, is the Syrian war goes global. that Russia and Iran, on the side of supporting Assad, the rest of us, for reasons that have to do with a sense of domestic vulnerability to terrorism, get pulled further and further in. This feels like World War I in the making.
By the way, I think I wrote that last week, but it does.
I crib most of my good ideas from stuff you've written.
Thank you. But it feels kind of like the Balkans on steroids. Everything connects, and the bigger problem is not necessarily the fight with, you know, ISIS or terrorist groups. The bigger problem is the potential tensions within the groups that are involved in the fight against ISIS and the terrorist groups, the Russians, the Iranians, the U.S., the Europeans, some of the Gulf states, et cetera. So that kind of multi-layer Gordian knot of conflicts is a potential problem.
It's going to affect those countries' relations with each other beyond the Middle East.
Right, exactly.
It will affect everything else because we are sadly not solving this problem.
So I'm going to pick up on that and be a little contrarian. I'm going to throw out there that as important as we think the Syrian or the Russian element is to the rise of ISIS and to what extent people are going to be paying attention to this, I'm going to say that it being 2016 and a presidential year, everything is going to be viewed by Americans through a very domestic lens. And so in that way, I think that it's the homegrown threat that is going to really be dominating terrorism coverage, terrorism stories, terrorism interest here in the United States, particularly after what we saw with San Bernardino. With those threats, particularly what we're seeing our allies in Europe dealing with similar attacks, Paris, even Lebanon, at Mali. So I think that when we have the FBI director, Jim Comey, come out and say, there is so much more we don't know about this, and by the way, we really don't know how to stop it. We don't know when the people in the San Bernardino shootings were radicalized, how they were radicalized, and what we are supposed to do to try to prevent this phenomena from happening. This is something that people have been talking about since 9/11. There's been a lot of research done about radicalizations in prisons. Clearly, this is no longer the case. Clearly, these two people were not radicalized in a prison. They were the wife in the case was allowed into the United States from Pakistan on a legal visa. The husband was a U.S. citizen. So there's something going on here that the world has not yet been able to put its finger on in terms of how do we try to prevent people from looking at the dark side of whatever ideology is out there. So I'm going to say that if we're going to think of ISIS as one big news story for 2016, that would be my supposition as to how we look at it. The second, and David, this is Rothkopf, this is a good segue for you. I think that China is going to be another big story for 2016, again, under the prism of it's a presidential year. What do most Americans care about during presidential years? They care about the economy. They care about jobs. They care about their pocketbooks, and that's how they vote. And we see China, which has been rising for some time, really roar to the forefront on these issues. We have the Chinese currency has just been allowed into the elite group.
Whenever you start talking about economic issues, my head starts to spin.
Oh, God.
Excuse me, but who wrote the longest books, impossibly long books, on just this subject? Wasn't it you? The books are longer than the titles on my books.
Well, this is really troubling as we turn. Go on. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, Laura.
I'm troubled that you're troubled.
I'm hearing something in my headset, but it's interference.
I'm going to take the other side of Laura's argument.
Well, let her finish.
The collapse of China is going to be a big story.
Okay. Well, that's a possibility. Go ahead, Laura. Well, now that your argument's been undercut, go ahead.
Well, yeah. You know, maybe I should just stop there. But I do want to note that China is trying to present a more progressive face to the world. We've seen recently that the leadership, Xi, is now going to recognize some 13 million Chinese children who have not been recognized, the second children who have not been allowed to register from families. They are now going to be recognized. They are clearly trying to build up their population. This is something that people are going to be watching very closely.
Let me offer a couple of things. First of all, as far as David's first story goes on Syria, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but we are actually not going to make any material progress. There may be some political negotiation. The political negotiation may actually suggest that we're making material progress, but it's actually just a negotiation about Assad transition and will not actually materially have an effect on the rest of the conflict in Syria.
It's a negotiation about the Assad transition only in the effort to try to get everybody focused on ISIS. And I think the big question is, does it succeed in getting people focused on ISIS and distracted from Assad?
Right. So I'm suggesting that my conclusion is probably not. But having said that, they may say they are, but I just don't think that we're going to be coordinated enough to handle that. But having said that, here's what I think. If I take the cyber story, I take the discussion about whether it's domestic terrorism or terrorism abroad and take some of these other things, I think 2016 is going to be a terrible year for civil liberties around the world. I think this is going to be a year when the European governments, the U.S. governments, and other governments use this as an opportunity to crack down on a whole range of potential infractions, but to overreach and to overreach in terms of listening and surveillance and to overreach in terms of closing borders and intolerance. And I think that's going to be a very big story for next year. Another big story that I think the Fed's first interest rate rise in almost 10 years.
And we'll probably have almost no immediate effect.
Right.
Except, but it could have a long-term effect.
Right. But the effect ultimately, I think, is the U.S. currency ends up being stronger relative to the currencies of a lot of emerging markets. And a bunch of emerging markets, and I include in that Brazil and Turkey and potentially China, look like 2016 could be a kind of a rough year, a slow year for them. And if we get into a year in which there is something of a slowdown in emerging markets, exacerbated by this kind of thing, that has a whole bunch of secondary effects beyond simply the social effects of a slowdown within those economies. And so I think that could be a very large story. A third story, and then you guys may elaborate on all of this, is I think Hillary Clinton's going to be elected president of the United States. But even if Hillary Clinton is not elected president of the United States and Marco Rubio is elected president of the United States, which I think is the second most likely possibility, we're going to see the end of the Obama era in the United States. And the end of the Obama era and the movement to a new era of American leadership, which is not going to look or feel like the Obama era.
Thank goodness.
Because it's going to be more assertive, I think is also going to be a big deal. And I think by the end of the year, you're going to see world leaders, most of them kind of salivating and waiting for the clock to tick over and to be able to pat Barack Obama on the back and to be able to move on to a different kind of role for the U.S. And there'll be a few world leaders out there, and among them I would include Vladimir Putin and the Ayatollah Khomeini and some others who are going to be a little bit nervous about a somewhat more assertive United States. Aren't I right?
I hate to actually be caught in agreement with Rothkopf on almost anything, but I'm feeling unusually charitable. So I will disagree slightly on the Syria part and sort of agree with all of the rest. So let me tell you which part I disagree with on Syria. I think having flown around the world on more trips than I'd care to think about with Secretary Kerry as he has tried to sort of piece this together, what strikes me is that we have a brief moment of opportunity here where the fundamental interests of the Russians, the Iranians, the United States, and the European allies are generally in agreement. And we've also got a period where every one of these members, as you point out, has got a somewhat different agenda of how they're going to go get there. But I think there's enough there to build on that you may get a partial ceasefire. And the big question is, are people actually all going to be training their guns on ISIS, or is this going to be a, pardon me, Corey, George W. Bush-style coalition of the willing where you've got two or three countries actually doing the fighting and some others sort of signing up to it? And I think that's Obama's big challenge.
What is the commonality of interest you see between the Russians, Iranians, and us on Syria?
Just the question I was going to ask.
I'm so glad you asked that question. I think that for very different reasons, each one of them is more worried about ISIS and the rise of a Sunni semi-state than they are about their other issues.
What evidence is there that's the case for the Russians?
Okay, so for the Russians, I don't think they actually particularly care about Assad. They care about keeping their base in Syria. For the Iranians, I think they do care about Assad, but they fear that if the United States and Russia together are in Syria in a bigger way against ISIS, they're going to lose some of their own influence. So I think they feel that they've got to stay in and stay in on the ground. And remember, it's the Iranians doing the ground fighting for everybody right now to the degree that there is much ground fighting going on.
No, it's a fantastic situation of the United States flying air support for
Iran.
Yeah, that's great.
So there's that part. On the part about Hillary Clinton and the part about civil liberties, I think David actually is right. So where we are on this is Hillary Clinton gave a speech the other day in which she basically said, I know there are going to be a lot of complaints about the First Amendment as we begin to think about how to get radicals off of the internet. But she sort of dismissed it. Now, for somebody who spent her entire life as a civil liberties lawyer in some form or another, I thought that was a somewhat remarkable statement. She has staked herself out to the right of President Obama on Iran. She has staked herself out to the right on ISIS. And I think you're right that as she comes in, you will see a more assertive United States. Will that worry our allies? I don't think it's going to worry them that much initially. I think they're going to welcome this for a while. They think they understand who Hillary Clinton is. They think that, you know, they've all dealt with her, obviously, in her time as Secretary of State. I don't think that's going to particularly worry them, at least for the first year or two.
Laura, be honest. The only two people who are going to miss Barack Obama are Vladimir Putin and Ayatollah Khomeini.
And you.
I'm gonna miss Barack Obama. That's for sure.
Well, I mean, it's less easy fodder for your copy, I suspect.
Oh my God, what do you think this is? Like, you know, you know, stand up comedy? We're just looking to, you know, make the joke here? I mean,
oh, poor David.
I'm sitting here. All I want is a peaceful, more happy world.
Could we follow the comparison between Rothkopf, Ayatollah, the Ayatollah, and Putin just for a few more beats, Laura?
Being the one here who works at foreign policy, I'm going to say let's change topics.
You're the one who delivered the biggest payload, Laura.
You know, drops the mic, walks off the stage.
Oh, my
that's
God.
All I got. I want to actually go back to something Sanger said, because I'm curious. And respect that you are getting probably more organic reporting while you're on the trail.
Yeah,
with...
but this is also...
Okay,
Sanger,
let me just
no,
finish.
But wait, you know he's on the plane and he's like all native. You know, they're like traveling around and it's like, you know, you spend all this time with all the State Department people and all of a sudden you start buying
you
their bullshit.
You start thinking they're actually doing something.
Right. Yeah,
no,
exactly.
Actually, having spent a lot of time on that same plane, I can say that that is actually not true. But
yeah.
It all comes down to how much sleep you get.
That's
is,
right.
Is really what it comes down to. But, you know, when you say that everybody... is in agreement that ISIS is bad and something needs to be done about ISIS when we talk about the coalition that is meeting in Vienna. To me, that sounds a lot like everybody agrees that the sun should rise in the east and set in the west every day. And so the real point is, and the real problem as I see it, is this massive division on what to do about Assad. And maybe you know something I don't, but it doesn't look like there is a strong agreement or, you know, any kind of resolution on at what point does Assad go, if in fact he goes at all. So I'm not clear on where it is that Putin is not really supporting Assad anymore. I thought Putin was very happy selling his weapons programs to Assad. I thought Putin was very happy with the base, as you said.
I think that Putin's view, and he doesn't check in with me. He might check in with David since, you know, they're of a type.
Fellow travelers.
But I think that it's very possible that—
Of a type, you mean masculine, shirtless, bear wrestling—
Do we need to just throw up in their mouth?
Do
wow.
We need to make our podcast listeners think of the image of you shirtless as they're headed off to their New Year's holiday, please.
One of those things you can't unsee.
This has devolved.
Yeah, right. So I do think the Russians care much more about having a government they can manipulate, and they see Assad as basically not a long-termer. And so I think they want to position themselves so that they and the Iranians together can pick his successor.
That's
Hold
it.
On one second, Pootie Poot. So
whoa!
The only response to that that I have is that until one deals with Assad, the ideology that's driven by Sunni extremists in Syria, whether it's Qaeda, whether it's Daesh, whether it's one of the other extremist groups, cannot be resolved. So, and I think that's one of the arguments that the State Department
wrong.
Has been
saying. Wrong. He finally said something correct. Listen, the Russians and the Iranians are there for one reason. They want to make sure that they get to pick the next regime in Damascus because they see Damascus as the lid that keeps this shit from spreading over into Russia or spreading over into Iran. They, frankly, both benefit from the unrest that exists elsewhere in Syria, which is why they are not going to throw themselves in any serious way to any combat of it. Because, frankly, if you're Putin, you want the unrest and the refugees flowing into Europe, promoting anti-refugee sentiment, promoting the right wing, weakening the EU, and thus dealing with your longer-term strategic
issue. How does that differ from what I said, that Russia and Iran don't want Assad to go?
No, I don't think they care. The Russians and the Iranians have been willing to throw Assad under the bus so long as they get to pick a successor.
Does that depend then, in your opinion, on a state of Syria that's broken up, that Damascus is its own little pond?
Syria is becoming like Iraq and like Yemen and like Afghanistan, which is to say countries in name – where there is a government and a capital city that controls the capital city in some of the country, but not the whole country.
And that's what I thought was the most outlandish part of the statement that came out at the end of the first big Vienna meeting, which was that everybody committed to a unified Syria. And in my discussions with the participants during the Vienna conference, I don't think any of them think that Syria is going to emerge as a
state. Well, they're committed to a unified but much smaller Syria.
Well, it could well be. But they do have a real fear that this explains how the United States shifted its position here from Assad has to go to Assad should go at some point in the future in some referendum that will take place after Barack Obama has left office.
Totally.
And the reason that they got there was they don't want a vacuum in Damascus that is filled either by ISIS or by the Russians.
Right, because look what happened to Iraq, right?
I just got to tell you, there's going to be a little party. Bashar al-Assad, a few of his close friends, January 22nd, 2017, when they sit there and they're like saying, Barack Obama's gone, and we're still here.
Castro gets invited, doesn't he?
Yeah. You know,
and Kim
they
Jong-un.
Raise a glass, and they go, how'd that all work out for your world? But that's 2017. And we're really trying to deal with 2016. Corey, I want to give you one last shot. Is there a 2016 story of any sort, cultural, sports, political, fashion that we've missed out here?
And by the way, the joint fishing trip and wrestling match between Putin and David does not count.
I would let him listen. I will kick his ass.
Excellent. So finally we have a way to rid Russia of the despot that's strangling civil liberties in that country.
He may be
but at least foreign policy with their same problem.
Excuse me.
But foreign policy already has that problem. Vladimir Putin's not to blame.
Do you ever watch The Sopranos, dude?
Not really, no.
Fuck with Jersey at your own risk. Corey?
Yes, I think the Japanese economy rebounds as the Chinese economy collapses. And so all of a sudden, Asia is going to look very different because the Japanese are going to pull out of a 15-year-long nosedive and begin to be a more confident society, begin to be more magnetic in Asia.
That's Corey, fantastic.
I have a really expensive sushi restaurant in your town in Palo Alto that I love to eat at. Can we wager a dinner there on that particular prediction?
Yeah,
for
let's us remember Sanger's previous assignments. all right, Lara, pick something even more arcane than that. The Kazakh transit system will have major steps forward in 2016. No, what? Where do you go? Another story? Come on.
I'm still fixated on, you know, the Putin comparison with the Kardashian West moderating.
Okay, I'm going to give you one. Adele's record will be the number one selling record for the whole year. It will be the number one record of 2015 and the number one record of 2016.
Maybe. But, you know, actually, if we're going to go there, I would wonder what, Corey, maybe you can chime in on this, what Silicon Valley is doing about music and about piracy and about all of the, especially what Adele is doing is preventing some of these groups from having her record sold online, right? I mean, she wants people to go out to stores and things. So I wonder what social media is going to do about this kind of phenomena in a place, in a time where people are getting their news, their music, all sorts of consumer products online.
Large Jakes, hopelessly nerdy. David Sanger.
Okay. I think a much higher chance that the Red Sox are actually going to put the team back together again than that the Japanese
that's
are going to put their team back together again.
Okay. Well, that's all I get from that is that Japan's in trouble. All right. Well, look, folks, if you listen to this podcast, you now know what's going to happen in 2016. We are never wrong. Well, we've never done this before. So this is our first predictive podcast for the year ahead. We'll see whether we were wrong. But you'll only know if you come back for some future episode of the podcast. Please do. Have a happy new year. And join us again on the Editor's Roundtable sometime soon.
You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe, please visit foreignpolicy.com. And thank you very much for joining us.